Hi.
We can hear you.
Okay.
Good to hear. Sorry about that.
No problem.
So to start things off, the top kill operation that BP undertook this past weekend to begin addressing the oil spill into the Gulf of Mexico was yesterday declared a failure. And with limited options, it's safe to call that Gulf oil spill a major American crisis. So we want to hopefully today look at how far that stigma of an oil spill will reach. And this past week, a few of the Times articles have addressed these types of environmental questions. So, Colleen, can you tell us a little bit about some of the recent stories from the Times about environmental safety regulations? To start, Mitchell Anderson wrote today about some immediate concerns for British Columbians. So what would an oil spill mean for our province?
Well, it could be devastating, and it seems that... can you hear me okay now?
We can hear you. We just have a little bit of feedback, and I apologize. That's just our old equipment here at the University Station.
Okay, yeah. I mean, especially considering that the provincial government is supporting a plan to build a pipeline across the province from Edmonton to Kitimat that would carry oil and bring a lot of tanker traffic to the coast. You know, it's a big issue for British Columbia. And Mitchell Anderson's report brings to light some of the regulatory concerns around this. After the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989, the federal government created six advisory councils. So these are independent panels comprised of local experts whose mandate is to advise the Minister of Transport on oil spill preparedness and response. So if something were to happen, are we ready for it? Can we handle it? So the Pacific Regional Advisory Council on Oil Spill Response is mandated to be a watchdog, essentially, for marine oil safety and communicate with the public on their findings. Given the support for this pipeline, which would result in more tanker traffic, in light of the Gulf spill, increasing concerns about these kinds of emergencies, you'd think this board would be a good thing, a given. But late last year, as Mitchell Anderson uncovered, Transport Canada started dismantling the board that serves as a watchdog for oil spill safety and preparedness. They limited meetings to just two per year. Members were denied access to drafts of changes to marine oil safety regulations that are in the works. Members were denied a modest travel budget to engage communities about increased tanker traffic on the BC coast. And according to one member of the council, these moves appear to be because the board had become, in his words, a burr in the saddle for Transport Canada. He said, "It's quite clear they're not going to give it a budget. They're not going to allow you to have more meetings. And they didn't want anybody howling, so they got rid of most of the members." Now, this member, who says he does not speak on behalf of the board, believes that other jurisdictions have recognized that vigilance around tanker traffic requires public engagement and transparency, and that's not happening here.
So this sounds a lot very similar, actually, to another article that was on the tie recently, one from Jeff Dimbecki, who is looking into a bit more of a federal case. Maybe you could kind of compare what's happening in Canada in terms of provincial versus national, because Jeff had highlighted Canada, the federal government, rather quietly gutting environmental assessment laws. Is that right?
Yeah, the Tories introduced big revisions to the Environmental Assessment Act just months before a review of the Act is supposed to take place. Bill C-9 was tacked onto the Conservatives' budget bill earlier this year. So that means that the opposition couldn't vote it down without voting down the budget and triggering an election. Proposed rules under Bill C-9 would grant the Environment Minister the power to reduce the scope of reviews and put many infrastructure projects on an exemption list. Now, while Environment Minister Jim Prentice claims that the environmental assessment or the EA process is fundamentally the same, critics argue that the changes will turn the Act into HASH, that it's undemocratic, and in the words of federal liberal energy critic David McGuinty, these changes are guided by a hidden mandate and are driven by money. So Jeff Dembicki, you know, followed the money. He tracked down some lobbying records for a firm called Global Public Affairs. Their client list includes Shell and the Canadian Energy Pipeline Association, which represents many of the players in the oil sands. And according to these records, for lobbyists, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act is a major area of interest. They've sought to enhance and streamline the assessment of pipeline projects. And federal records show that Encana, another corporation with interest in the oil sands, lobbied in relation to the policy for cumulative effects assessment and management. So this cumulative effects is a major area of concern for critics of the revisions to the EA Act. They're worried that the changes will change the scope for the environmental assessment process, so that cumulative impacts of a project, especially a huge project like those in the tar sands, won't be addressed. What's more, Dembicki noted that the move blindsided a regulatory advisory committee that was formed in 1992 to advise government on the Environmental Assessment Act. In 2008, the group's activities came to a mysterious halt. First, one meeting was postponed and then put off again. And one member of the committee said she wasn't even sure if it officially existed anymore.
So obviously these are very rather disconcerting patterns that are happening across provincial and national politics in terms of how our leaders are handling what any type of regulation around the environment, especially because we are seeing such devastating effects of what's happening off the Gulf of Mexico, because it's not something that can easily be fixed, as we saw with the Top Kill. You know, it's something that failed miserably, and now they're trying something else, and scientists are saying that that even won't be the end-all be-all. So it is rather disconcerting, and I'm really happy that the has been able to highlight these stories. Aware of, unfortunately, our time constraint because of these technical difficulties we had earlier, I want to jump now to a story that was recently published on the Tai. It relates to something that we spoke about 2 weeks ago. You brought us a story from Katie Hislop about the Ministry of Children and Family Development. I guess Katie had spoken with former workers who remarked about budget constraints and heavy workloads at the ministry, and Andrew had asked you whether or not the ministry had responded to this. So now Katie has followed up on that story with an interview from Child and Family Minister Mary Polak. So can you tell us a little bit about what Katie's conversation with the minister was like?
Yeah, well, I mean, Katie asked, for example, why hasn't the ministry hired on more than 17 new frontline worker positions since 2001? Why isn't the ministry replacing workers who retire, quit, or go on leave? And the minister's answer was, well, it's hard. She said, this is not an easy job, and we are doubly challenged because we have many rural and remote areas. So she did say, though, that she wants to stick with the job. There have been three different ministers of this children and family development since 2006, and Polak indicated that she wants this job, she wants this ministry, and she's here for the long run.
So it sounds a lot like Honorable or Mary Polak was saying, was rather. She was hoping that she could keep her position. She was acting politically, and she was just trying to defend her post. But was she really getting into the substantial questions that Katie was asking?
Well, she stood by her previous assertions that recommendations, the Hughes recommendations, and just to backtrap a bit, a former judge, Ted Hughes, conducted a 2006 independent investigation into BC's child welfare system. He made 62 recommendations, and Minister Polak and the provincial government, you know, they stand by their assertion that all of those recommendations have been implemented, despite the child welfare watchdog and Hughes himself saying, no, they haven't. So I'm not sure how you can, it seems like a dead-end argument, you know, yes, no, back and forth. But the good thing is that the watchdog, Mary Ellen Terpelafond, who is the government-appointed representative for children and youth in the province, is currently producing a report on the status of those recommendations. So perhaps when she does, compile all of her research and release that report, maybe the ministry or the provincial government will be forced to reconsider their position that all the recommendations have been implemented.
And I hate to gush, but that is the great thing about the TAI, is that you are able to follow up on these stories, and we can have these memes where we can come back to you in a few weeks and we can see what's been any developments on these issues. So I really do look forward to speaking with you again on Monday, and maybe we can follow up on what's happening in the environment or local politics. But thanks again, Colleen, for joining us today on the show.
You're welcome.
So that was Colleen Kimmett from thetai.ca. And for more on all these stories, please visit thetai.ca. That's thetyee.ca. This past week, news director Andrew Longhurst started looking into the projected $1.1 billion security costs for the upcoming G8 and G20 meetings in Ontario later this month. To address this figure, Andrew spoke with MPs from the opposition parties who have been on the front line of this debate.
Many Canadians are still shocked about the security cost of hosting the G8 and G20 meetings in June, as the costs are expected to top $1 billion. The G8 summit runs from June 25th to June 26th in Huntsville, Ontario, in Canada's Muskoka region. Following the G8 summit, Toronto will host the G20 from June 26th to June 27th. $160 million was originally budgeted for security, but has since jumped to $1.1 billion. The Conservative government has been on the defensive, and Public Safety Minister Vic Taze has continued to defend the now $1.1 billion as a necessary expense, even though other host countries have provided security for far less, even less than $100 million. On Thursday, May 27th, I spoke with Mark Holland, the Liberal opposition critic for public safety, as well as Don Davies,